Welcome back to Uprising. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. It's the diagnosis that most parents dread. Your child has attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, or ADHD. Today, increasing numbers of parents are facing the prospect of dealing with developmental diagnoses such as ADHD, administering drugs like Ritalin or Adderall, and whether or not they decide to medicate their kids, of helping them manage educational and social expectations. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention found that in 2003, 7.8% of 4 to 17-year-olds had been diagnosed with ADHD. 4 years later, it was 9.5%. In 2011, that number jumped to 11% of school-aged children. There is ongoing debate about what is behind these increasing rates and whether it's simply a matter of overdiagnosis, misdiagnosis, or the global push for academic performance. Joining me to help navigate that debate as part of our series on the science of health is Dr. Deborah Budding. She is a board-certified neuropsychologist who works with children, adolescents, and adults in the greater Los Angeles area. She's co-authored multiple publications emphasizing habit formation and non-conscious subcortical brain contributions to function. She's a supervising faculty member at Harbor UCLA's neuropsychology training program. Welcome to Uprising, Dr. Budding.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks so much for joining us. So let me just jump right into it. There is a school of thought, particularly as you go into the alternative health circles, that ADHD is entirely made up, that it's simply a disorder that doesn't exist, and it's all just society's expectations on kids that kids can't live up to. Is ADHD an actual disorder that needs treatment?
I would say most people who have been diagnosed with ADHD would absolutely say it's very real. Mm-hmm. But it is a culturally, to some degree, when somebody's diagnosed with it, it's culturally determined what is a maladaptive behavior, for example. But it's absolutely real.
And so when you say it's a real disorder, what does that actually mean? Because, you know, when you have cancer, you have cancer. When you're pregnant, you're pregnant. There are no two ways about it. But when we talk about neuropsychology, it can be a little fluid.
It can, which I think is one of the things that makes it so difficult. That one of the challenges we have in the mental health field is that the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual that people use to make these diagnoses, is behavior-based. It's not directly linked to the brain. And so when you're dealing with a neurodevelopmental disorder, my colleagues and I who do, we're called theory and practice. We do trainings together. One of the things we talk about is the idea of if water is not coming out of a hose, is the problem at the end of the hose? You're looking at systems.
Right.
Okay, so there are lots of different ways that a behavior or a set of behaviors happen from a brain perspective and from a body perspective. And it's not like there's one thing that causes ADHD. It's a multi-determined diagnosis. And no two people really who are diagnosed with ADHD are exactly the same either. So it can be a cause of confusion, I think, for a number of parents. And also, ADHD is sort of a misnomer, in a sense, that Martha Denkla is a researcher who basically came up with the saying that it's really more of a disorder of intention. So it really should be called intention deficit disorder, because the real challenges of ADHD are a person's ability to form and then implement intentions and to interact with their environment in a way that's effective and can meet the demands of the environment.
So how do you explain the increasing rates of ADHD that we see? I cited a number of statistics, and, you know, by medical standards, these are huge jumps in diagnoses.
You know, I think people come at this question from a lot of different directions. One is certainly there's a very strong genetic component to ADHD. For information about this, I'm a huge fan of science Twitter. So Kevin Mitchell does, he's at Wiring the Brain, very knowledgeable on genetics, and I recommend checking out his work for information on that. I would say, in my position, I don't see a lot of kids who don't have ADHD being misdiagnosed. Sometimes I see people who have a lot of comorbidity, which means multiple diagnoses. So you can have anxiety, and you can have ADHD, and you can have other things. I do think that there needs to be care and caution and a great deal of thoughtfulness when you make diagnoses. So,
and you think that there is not as much care and caution these days, or is it hard to tell?
I don't know. It's hard to tell because so many different people can make a diagnosis of ADHD. So
right, it's not just one kind of doctor. Or
exactly,
one kind of,
exactly, and there can be differences in training in terms of what people emphasize, etc.
Which is part of the problem, I think, and also part of the public confusion over this.
I agree. That's one reason why actually my colleagues and I are going to be doing some web-based programming on neurodevelopmental disorders and trying to help people understand them both from a neuropsychological and current neuroscience perspective, but also from a kind of a more neurodiverse view as well.
And what about the efficacy of drugs like Ritalin and Adderall for those who really struggle with the disorder? Are those drugs actually helpful?
Well, I mean, I don't prescribe, so I can't really say. But I have certainly in my practice and with people I know seen properly prescribed stimulant medications really be lifesavers for people. So I think...
And does it go the other way too?
The opposite of a lifesaver, I've never actually seen that. But we
hear anecdotal evidence of kids who have been diagnosed with Ritalin and Adderall, et cetera, whose sort of personality gets deadened.
Yes, and that's not something that's not okay. That's not how it's supposed to work. So one of the reasons I like doing very comprehensive, very persnickety kinds of evaluations is to help people who do prescribe make useful choices and to make sure that, stimulant medications really only work for a percentage of people who are diagnosed with ADHD, and they can be very effective with certain kinds of disinhibition, right? Mm-hmm. But, for example, inattentive ADHD or kind of sluggish cognitive tempo, that's a subset of ADHD that sometimes responds to stimulants, sometimes doesn't respond to stimulants. But when they work, they can work quite well and can make the difference for a student really, really struggling and doing fantastic.
So let me get real personal here, something I hadn't really intended on doing, but I think it really does matter to bring up, for example, a parent's perspective. My own son was diagnosed with ADHD, which I utterly don't believe, and I basically said to myself, I would do anything before I medicate him. That would be the last thing I do, and he's doing fine. You know what I mean? He needed to emotionally mature, and he's doing great, and I find the expert opinion that was given to diagnose him as being full of crap.
I have to say, I see a lot of people who come into my office who supposedly have ADHD and they leave understanding that they don't. So that attention isn't one thing. And I think that's something that gets lost. A lot of things can cause problems with attention. And sometimes, anxiety in particular can have a huge impact on attention.
So kids who are socially anxious about being in social situations.
Right. Yeah. And impulsivity is not all the same either. There's the, again, you can describe problems with attention being due to your sort of emotional system figuring out what in the environment is worthy of attention, okay?
Right.
And so one of the jokes that we have is that ADHD is more that nothing is interesting enough to keep your attention and it's sort of the oh shiny, right? But on anxiety side, everything kind of has an equal valence and it becomes very difficult to determine what merits attention because everything is equally scary or equally concerning. And so that's a whole other kind of attention problem, and it's very real as well.
On the first that you mentioned, how much of or how much do you think our current model of education has to do with how children might be reacting in their environment and being diagnosed? Because if things aren't holding their attention, maybe the model of schooling itself is problematic. We know more and more these days that that scientists are realizing kids need to get up and move. They need to move and move and move.
Yes.
Whereas in conventional schools, we sit them down at desks and they, at least for large chunks of time, cannot move, and that can drive a kid crazy.
Yeah, well, it drives me crazy. this sort of gets to my and my colleagues' basic approach is very sensory motor based. It's much more about sensory motor development and movement and the importance of movement to development. And so I'm a big fan of Daniel Wolpert's work, and he has a, usually when I'm giving talks to large audiences, I play a small clip of his The Real Reason for Brains, where he talks about why we have a brain. And his idea, and this is not just his idea, it's a lot of people's, is the idea that we have a brain so that we can voluntarily control movement. That if you don't need to move, you don't need to have a brain.
And this is part of sort of how our brains evolve.
Exactly.
So, the idea is that our brains didn't necessarily evolve to rationalize and think and, design large buildings, but to move, to physically be able to move ourselves from one place to another?
Well, yes, because, again, we're either doing something or we're thinking about doing something or we're regretting something we did, right? So everything that we do in life is really about doing things. Huh. And so thought is, you know, one way of considering thought is that it's offline movement and we're planning movement. We're learning from our experiences, okay? So when we're asking children to sit for long periods of time and engage with only one portion of themselves, I think that's asking a bit too much. And actually, one of the things I recommend for kids who have ADHD, and for kids who don't, for that matter, is a tremendous amount of physical movement. And for kids who have ADHD, to have a period of very intensive aerobic exercise before beginning school is very helpful. And there's actually some schools in the area that have the potential for students to do that before they try to sit down.
Or even designing classrooms where you're not sitting in one place looking at a blackboard and one or whiteboard on one end of the classroom.
Yes, and more engaged. I like those big bouncy balls. I like sitting on those. They're good for core development. Mm-hmm. Although some kids end up kicking them around the room.
So. Isn't managing or helping children manage society's and educational institutions' expectations of them, isn't it better for us to design our systems to help kids manage them without the use of drugs?
See, I don't really see it as either or, because for a lot of people, if one of the main issues for their particular ADHD presentation is disinhibition, that is very hard to manage without any kind of medicine at all. But it's also not magical pixie dust. And I tell this to parents all the time. If your child or if you are somebody who will benefit from some kind of stimulant medication, you still have to learn to manage yourself. You still have to, it's also not an excuse. When I'm meeting with children and with teachers sometimes, I'll talk about the fact that I'm horrifically nearsighted. And I can't just decide not to wear my glasses when I'm driving my car, because if the police officer pulled me over, I can't say, "Officer, I couldn't see the stop sign. I'm nearsighted," right? He'd say, "Why aren't you wearing your glasses?" Right. So I really like to have people respect their neurologies, essentially.
Does this, the line of inquiry about how our brains evolved to make us, look at our movement to rather than be designed to help us think, does this have an implication on autism spectrum disorders as well? I know that that's an area that you work on as well.
And I wouldn't say it's an either or. I mean, I think thinking's important. I mean, I prefer to be able to think. I think most people do.
Some of us make our living through just thinking, sitting on a chair and thinking.
Exactly. But yes, this is also relevant for autism spectrum disorders, and I'm fairly passionate about autism spectrum disorders and about neurodiversity. And in this community as well, I don't like taking this disease approach to autism. At the same time, I think it disrespects people with disabilities to not acknowledge that there are differences that are disabling. Although disability is contextual, so in certain circumstances, whether you are disabled or not, to some degree, depends on what the environment is asking you to do and whether you're able to do it.
I think that what you just said is such a crucial issue that doesn't often come up when we think about these kinds of quote-unquote diseases.
Yes. I tend to, with neurodevelopmental disorders, I tend not to take so much a disease approach, although certain diseases such as epilepsy, et cetera, do have psychiatric diagnoses that go along with them. But again, that's why with neurodevelopmental issues, it's not a one-size-fits-all right. kind of thing. And it does take a certain degree of subtlety. But I also think it also just takes basic respect and caring mm-hmm. for people.
Which we don't have enough of in our society. On that
Sadly.
Note, I want to thank you so much for this very nuanced discussion of ADHD. Thank you so much, Dr. Deborah
My
Budding.
Pleasure.
My guest is Dr. Deborah Budding. She is a board-certified neuropsychologist who works with children, adolescents, and adults in the greater Los Angeles area. And her website, where you can find out more about her work, is DeborahBudding, that's with two Ds, .com. If you missed that, just check our website, uprisingwithsonali.com.